Now, if I weren't going through a series on the book of Daniel, if I were just preaching Daniel 8 as a standalone sermon this evening, it would have at least two implications. Number one, you'd doubtless be wondering why the dickens I'd chosen to preach a standalone sermon on Daniel 8. And number two, I wouldn't be able to ask the question, how does Daniel 8 compare with Daniel 7? Because some of you might not have read Daniel 7 for a very long time. But of course, I am going through a series on Daniel, and that means that you aren't wondering why I'm taking you to this passage this evening. And it means I can ask the question, how does Daniel 8 compare with Daniel 7? And that, in fact, is precisely the question I do want to ask this evening, and I'm going to offer two answers to it. So how does Daniel 8 compare with Daniel 7? Well, first of all, this is our first answer. It's similar, but apparently cheerless. It's similar, but apparently cheerless. So in comparing then these two chapters, by the way, we're kind of invited to do so by the way in which chapter 8 itself in the first verse references chapter 7. So in comparing these two chapters, really we're just comparing two visions. The vision that Daniel had in the first year of King Belshazzar's reign, that's chapter 7, and then the vision that Daniel had in the third year of Belshazzar's reign, that's chapter 8. And undoubtedly, these two visions are similar. I mean, that's fairly easy to see, isn't it? The central characters in both of these visions are creatures with horns. The summer before last, I had a rather disconcerting experience while on holiday in the Scottish Highlands. One night I was walking along a quiet lane in the dark, and I was just about to turn off the lane onto a path when suddenly I came face to face with a goat. And thinking then that a goat is pretty much just a sheep with a beard, I tried to kind of shoo it away, but whereas a sheep would normally respond to that and clear off, this goat didn't. It just stood there with a very aggressive expression on its face. So I decided that a sharp exit was probably wise, and I headed off down the narrow path that I'd been about to turn onto. And that seemed to do the trick, and I thought to myself, well, this poor goat, it probably just felt threatened, suddenly bumping into me unexpectedly. But now I've gone off down this path, it won't give me a second thought. All the same, I scampered down the path at quite a pace, and after about 100 metres, I turned off the path over a stile in a wall that took me onto the beach that was really my destination. Well, I didn't climb over the stile a moment too soon. I'd just done so when on the other side of that wall, on that path that I'd been on a few seconds earlier, there was this thundering of hooves as the goat came hurtling along, presumably in angry pursuit. If I'd still been on that path, I dread to think what would have become of me. And I guess that before I had that experience, I might have felt that Daniel's two visions in chapter 7 and chapter 8 aren't all that similar. The first one, after all, features these great beasts. The second, only a ram and a goat. What harm could they possibly do? But now that I realize what a formidable creature a goat can be, I can see that it's actually a perfectly reasonable counterpart for the beasts in the other vision. And so I'm saying then there's that basic similarity in both visions then. We have these formidable creatures with horns. And then when you delve into the interpretations that come with the visions, it's clear that both of them work in the same way. That is to say, the creatures themselves in both visions represent whole kingdoms. The horns, on the other hand, represent individual kings within those kingdoms. And indeed, we can go even further than that. Remember, I suggested last week that the fourth beast in chapter 7's vision, I suggested tentatively that it represents the Greek kingdom. and that the horn of the fourth beast that gets the most attention and that wreaks particular havoc and causes particular devastation, that horn may well be King Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, as we generally call him. Well, in this vision now, in chapter 8, we know for definite, don't we, that one of the creatures, the goat, represents the Greek kingdom. We're told that in verse 21 of our chapter, which makes it then practically certain in this case that the horn of the goat, which gets the most attention. Now, this is not the original horn mentioned in verse 5, described there as a conspicuous horn. That, I assume, is Alexander the Great, the kind of first of the Greek kings. That gets broken, of course, in verse 8. And is replaced first by four horns, but then another horn emerges. And it seems then that it's practically certain that that horn that emerges, which again causes such devastation, is again Antiochus Epiphanes. And so you can see then, I hope, how this vision in chapter 8 is similar to the vision in chapter 7. In terms of the form, it's similar. Creatures with horns. And in terms of the meaning, it's similar. The creatures are kingdoms. The horns are kings. And even when you get down to the specifics, there are similarities. The Greek Empire features in both, and indeed one particular Greek king, Antiochus, probably features in both. So you can see then how this vision is similar. But remember my heading a moment ago was this: it's similar but apparently cheerless. So what do I mean by that bit, by the apparently cheerless bits? Well, remember, the vision in chapter 7 wasn't cheerless. It was sobering, all right, depicting these successive earthly kingdoms as beasts. And it was especially sobering in its description of the fourth beast and the devastation caused by that one horn, probably, as we've been saying, Antiochus. It was sobering in chapter 7, but it wasn't cheerless. And really, two particular features, you may remember, ensure that the vision wasn't cheerless. First of all, the prominence of given language. That word given kept on appearing. So yes, these beastly kingdoms, and yes, this one savage horn, they exercise significant dominion in that vision, but only because that dominion was given to them. Given, presumably, by the sovereign God, the Ancient of Days. So that really, these kingdoms, and even that one savage king, really, they were just the agents of God himself. They were doing his bidding. They were doing his will. They were fulfilling his plan and his purpose. There was that definite emphasis to cheer us in chapter 7. And then the other thing that ensured it wasn't cheerless was the presence of the Son of Man section. Mike Johnson was saying to me yesterday that he's glad for this period of notable weather because it's ousted Brexit from the news headlines for a while. And I guess that Son of Man section there in the middle of the vision, similarly, it's a kind of welcome relief, isn't it? You've got all these beasts in the first part of the vision, and then you've got this horn causing devastation in the last part of the vision, but in the middle, you have some welcome relief. There's this Son of Man section. And so those two features then ensured that chapter 7's vision was not cheerless. But they're both absent from this vision in chapter 8. There's no given language, and nor is there a Son of Man section. Instead, it's all just beasts and horns, or creatures at least, fearsome creatures and horns. And that's what I mean then when I say it's apparently cheerless. Now, before we go any further, I suppose that if we are prepared to step back a bit here there are a couple of slightly positive observations that we could make. So first of all, an observation about God's knowledge. An observation about God's knowledge. I mean, really what this vision in chapter 8 is doing is this: it's zooming in on parts of the vision in chapter 7. So the vision in chapter 7, it covered four earthly kingdoms, a great sweep of history, four earthly kingdoms, and therefore it wasn't that detailed. This vision in chapter 8, on the other hand, it zooms in upon a shorter period. It only features two kingdoms, the ram and the goat. And indeed, its coverage of the one crucial horn, the savage horn, it also kind of displays this zoom effect. Do you remember how there was one detail about that horn that was mentioned in passing in chapter 7? And it was this in verse 25, the kind of third item in verse 25: he shall think to change the times and the law. And I said this is probably a reference then to Antiochus Epiphanes' attempt, as he persecuted the Jews there in the second century BC. This is probably a reference to his attempt to completely sabotage the law of Moses and completely tear it up and completely mess around with it. That's probably what is being referred to. He shall think to change the times and the law. And that detail then, just mentioned in passing in chapter 7, it's now kind of zoomed in on here, particularly in verses 11 to 13 of chapter 8. Now, these are difficult verses to get our heads around the meaning entirely, but I think the meaning goes something like this. So verse 11 begins, it became great — the it there is this horn, probably Antiochus — it became great, even as great as the prince of the host. I think host there refers to the angels, and the prince of the host then is God. I mean, he's often called the Lord of hosts, isn't he, in the Old Testament? Here, the prince of the hosts. It's not, of course, saying that objectively Antiochus actually became as great as God. Of course it's not. But it's talking about his blasphemous claims. Antiochus Epiphanes, he had written on coins. That is, Antiochus, the manifestation of God. That's what an epiphany is. He made these blasphemous claims. He made himself out to be as great as the Lord of hosts. That's what that is talking about. Then verse 11 continues in the ESV: and the regular burnt offering was taken away from him. I think that's probably then a kind of summary of the effect of Antiochus's persecuting campaign in Jerusalem, that the regular burnt offering, that is prescribed by the law of Moses, was taken away from him. The him there is Yahweh, stopped being offered to him. The regular burnt offerings were suspended. They were discontinued. They were terminated. And the place of his sanctuary, that's Yahweh's sanctuary, was overthrown. Now, Antiochus didn't literally destroy the temple, but he did so pervert its whole function and purpose that that's probably what is being talked about. And then verse 12, I think, is probably elaborating how Antiochus achieves this, how he kind of brings the regular sacrifices to a halt. And I think there's a change in the meaning of host here. Host, literally, the Hebrew word is army, and it can be used of angels, the Lord of hosts, or it can be used of a normal human army. And here I think it's Antiochus's army. And literally then what the verse says is that a host, an army, will be set over the regular burnt offering. And then you can see in the footnote, in an act of rebellion, i.e. rebellion against God. So Antiochus, in his pride, in his defiance of God, he will put his army in the temple, around the temple, to stop the Jews from carrying out their burnt offerings, to stop the priests, to stop the worshippers, to make sure that the law of Moses does not continue to be observed and the sacrifices don't continue. It continues then, and second half of verse 12, and he will throw truth to the ground, probably a reference to his hatred of the Torah. He burned any copies that he could find in Jerusalem, tried to completely destroy the law of Moses in that physical sense, obliterate it from history. And then just jumping to verse 13, where we have kind of an angelic voice kind of summing up Antiochus's campaign in Jerusalem, and just the reference there to the transgression that makes desolate. That probably is a reference to Antiochus erecting an idol to his own God in the very Jerusalem temple of Yahweh. That was the transgression that made the temple desolate. It made the temple a place devoid of true worship anymore. The God who had instituted the temple no longer worshipped in that temple. That transgression of Antiochus's just made the place, in God's eyes, desolate. And so you can see what I mean then about this shifting focus. Chapter 8 is kind of the big picture, shows all these, chapter 7, the big picture, all these earthly kingdoms. Not a great amount of detail. Chapter 8, on the other hand, zooming right in on the Greek kingdom, and then right in on Antiochus, and right in even on this one aspect of what Antiochus did in terms of suppressing and trying to finish off altogether the Jews' religion. And the combined effect then of the two, of chapter 7 and chapter 8, is this powerful sense, isn't it, of the comprehensiveness of God's knowledge of the future. I mean, you meet some people in life, don't you, whose knowledge is very specialist. I remember the first time I visited Cambridge to preach in the Presbyterian church there, before I took on a role in the church. After the evening service, I went round to the house of a family in the church for supper. And at one point, the guy whose house it was, he needed to change a light bulb. Now, I'm not a very practical person, as some of you know, and not a DIY expert by any means, but I do know how to change a light bulb. This guy clearly didn't have a clue what he was doing. Now, this man was literally the world expert in one particular field of theological investigation, and yet he couldn't change a light bulb. He was a specialist. On the other hand, you meet some people, don't you, who are generalists, and they can talk impressively about history or geography or whatever it might be. But if you then press them on something, that historical event you mentioned in passing a moment ago, can you tell me all about that, please? Then they're lost. They can't. They are generalists. Well, Daniel 7 and Daniel 8 are showing us that in his knowledge of the future, God is a generalist and a specialist. He knows the broad sweep of the future, and he also knows all the details of the future. His knowledge of it is comprehensive. That's such an encouraging thing, isn't it? That as you go into this week, as you go into this year, we're still at an early point of 2019, as you go into the rest of your life, as you go into, as we go into, as the world goes into the rest of history, our God is never, ever, ever going to be surprised or caught off guard by anything that happens. He has this comprehensive knowledge of the future, which, of course, he has, in fact, himself actually ordained. And then secondly here, just an observation about political turbulence. I mean, we think we're experiencing that, don't we? And you hear kind of words being thrown around like unprecedented. It's not that turbulent, is it, when you read Daniel chapter 8? This description of the goat charging toward the ram, Alexander the Great coming head to head with the Persian Empire. And it's frightening, isn't it? Just that the language that's used, the way in which in verse 5, as the goat charges, he doesn't even touch the ground. He's going so fast and he's full of wrath. He's enraged. And you see these kind of clashes, don't you, on planet Earth and so on. These clashes between animals with horns, and the kind of the footage slows down and you see these horns locking. And it's, you feel the impact almost as you're sitting on your sofa. And imagine living in those days then, when that kind of collision of superpowers was going on. I mean, people talk about, they use that language, don't they, of, you know, Corbyn and May locking horns. But of course, actually, they're sitting quite a few feet away from each other in a very civilized House of Parliament, just shouting at each other a bit. This was real combat. And God's people were living in those days. And God's people were watching the news each night. And God's people were wondering what on earth was going on. And it kind of puts it into perspective for us, doesn't it? In these Brexit-dominated days, actually things aren't all that turbulent at all. And so those are two kind of slightly positive observations then. But they don't alter this, my first heading. How does this vision in chapter 8 compare with the vision in chapter 7? Well, first of all, it's similar, but apparently cheerless. But we must move on to my second answer to the question, which is this. It's subtler, but actually comforting. How does it compare with chapter 7? It's subtler, but actually comforting. Because we don't have to step right back from our text this evening and scrape the barrel for positive stuff. No, there may be no given language in chapter 8. There may be no Son of Man section in chapter 8. But within the text itself, albeit in a subtler form, there is comforting material. And I just want to offer three examples of that as we close. First of all, notice with me a metaphor. A metaphor. And this is verse 9. Now, verse 9 then is talking about the emergence of the key horn, the savage horn, King Antiochus, and how then he grew exceedingly great, and he advanced in these different directions of the compass towards the south and towards the east. And then at the end of verse 9, we're told he also advanced towards the glorious land. And that's obviously a reference to Judah. I mean, apart from anything else, it's the introduction, isn't it, to that section then, which is going to talk about Antiochus and what he did in Jerusalem, what he did to the temple and so on. So clearly that's kind of where the Judah theme is introduced in verse 9. Antiochus, having done some stuff in that direction, he then turned his attention on the glorious land, on Judah, and the ensuing verses will tell you how exactly he did that. But there's two things to mention about this reference at the end of verse 9. First of all, the word land isn't actually there in the Hebrew text. We're back in Hebrew now, we're not in Aramaic anymore. The word land isn't there. It's just assumed by, I think, most of our English versions because of the geographical focus of the verse as a whole. But there's no particular reason to think, actually, that the verse is talking about Judah as a land, probably more talking about Judah itself, Judah as a people. And then the second thing to mention is that beautiful is a better rendering than glorious. Glorious is okay, but beautiful is a better rendering of the word. And actually, interestingly, it's a word that can mean beautiful, and it can also mean gazelle, as in the animal. And in the context of Daniel 8, I actually wonder whether that sense of the word perhaps is intended here. So we have Media and Persia represented as a ram, and we have Greece, represented as a goat. And now, I think perhaps in verse 9, we have Judah, represented as a gazelle. That's the metaphor that I'm talking about. And it's an interesting metaphor, because in the Old Testament, you often read about gazelles, and often gazelle is used in romantic contexts. I mean, this was seen as a beautiful animal. And particularly, actually, gazelles appear a lot in the Song of Solomon. In that love poem, both lovers speak of the other as a gazelle at different points. And here then we have, in this vision, Judah, represented not as another wild, unattractive animal to go along with the ram and the goats, but rather we have Judah represented as a gazelle. Why? Because that's what Judah is to God. Just as the woman in the Song of Solomon is a gazelle to her lover, so I think we may well be getting a little glimpse here in verse 9 of what Judah is to God, a beloved, a gazelle. And yes, Judah is here, of course, under God's chastising wrath. We saw last week, didn't we? We went to Hosea 13, and we saw there that actually all these beasts, they were really just the agents of God's chastising wrath against his people. That's why they've all been able to have a go at Judah. Not because Babylon and Persia and all the rest of them are just so inherently powerful, but rather because God is allowing this as a means of chastising his people. By the way, I think that's what is being referred to in verse 19, where the angel explaining to Daniel the vision says, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation." Whose indignation? Well, God's indignation. God's indignation against whom? Well, God's indignation, I think, against his own people, which lies behind all these successive kingdoms being able to dominate Judah. So yes, Judah here is under God's chastising wrath, but Judah is still God's beloved. Because that's just the type of God he is. He's this stubborn lover who will not withdraw his love from his people, even in the darkest days and even in the worst of times. And perhaps you're a Christian tonight who has lost sight of that truth. And perhaps you feel that God can only possibly be looking upon you this evening with disappointment, as a total failure in his eyes. And I'm saying, no, God looks upon you tonight with passionate, devoted, indestructible love. You're his gazelle. Or to put it in the corporate terms of this morning, you're part of this one people that is his gazelle, his beloved, his bride, the bride for his son, Jesus Christ. Understand yourself in those terms. Understand that you are beloved of God, even if you're in a dark place just now. A metaphor. Secondly, an echo. An echo. And this is verse 23, where the angel is still explaining things to Daniel at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold countenance shall arise. This is a reference again then to Antiochus, and he's going to arise then at this interesting point, when the transgressors have reached their limit. Who are the transgressors? Well, now I don't think we are talking about God's people. Now I think we're talking about these hostile forces who for centuries have been arrayed against God's people, from Nebuchadnezzar, who first deported them, the first beast, Babylon, all the way through to Antiochus. Antiochus is kind of bringing to an end this whole period when hostile rulers, yes, as we've just said, in fact, under God's chastising hand, but nonetheless, transgressively, sinfully, wrongfully, have been getting at Israel and dominating Israel and making life a nightmare for God's people. So the transgressors then refers to all these kind of kings, from Nebuchadnezzar through to Antiochus. And it's kind of viewing them as a single group. But it's this striking idea then that God isn't stepping in, didn't step in with Nebuchadnezzar and stop it happening then, didn't step in with Cyrus and stop it happening then, didn't step in later with Alexander the Great and stop it all happening then. He hasn't stepped in at all and stopped this kind of subjection of his people, because the reason given here is that the transgressors haven't yet reached their limits. And so it's this idea of kind of a certain quantity of sins having to be reached first. And I say this is an echo of what is it? Is it an echo? Well, it's an echo of Genesis chapter 15. In Genesis 15, God is speaking to Abraham, and he's promising to Abraham the land, Canaan. But of course, Abraham isn't going to get his hands on Canaan. He'll get a little tiny bit of it, but he won't get the land, essentially. It won't be for centuries that the land will actually be taken possession of by Abraham's descendants. Why is that? Why can't Abraham have it now? Well, God gives the reason. Verse 16. They, that's your descendants, shall come back here in the fourth generation. Why? Why can't we have the land now? For the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. The same idea, that God isn't going to step in yet and destroy the Amorites or Canaanites because their sins haven't yet reached the quantity. Now, they were pretty bad then in Abraham's day, let's make no mistake about it, but in God's eyes, they haven't yet reached that target, that quantity, at which point I shall step in. It's, by the way, a staggering testimony, isn't it, to what we sang a few minutes ago in Psalm 145, God being slow to anger. God being patient. God being a God who only reluctantly punishes. He will only ever punish anybody if he really, 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 really has to. That's the kind of God that we're presented with in the Bible. And so he's reluctant to destroy the Canaanites who sacrificed their children to their gods, who were vicious, savage, inhumane people. God is reluctant. He will only come down upon them when enough time has been given. And similarly here with these kingdoms, only when it gets to Antiochus, only then will the transgressions have reached their limit. But this is the thing. In Genesis 15, what is God going to do then? Once the Canaanites have reached the limit, what's God going to do? Is he just simply going to come down and destroy the Canaanites? Well, he is going to do that. But of course, he's going to do something more momentous than that, isn't he? And he explains it to Abraham there. He's going to redeem his people from Egypt. So the reaching of that target of transgressions will be the prelude to God doing something wonderful for his people and redeeming them. And I think when you've got that echo ringing in your head and you come to this passage, you're supposed to read something similar into it. That when the transgressions of all these wicked empires have reached their limit, yes, God will come and he will break, as it's put in verse 25, he will break Antiochus. But perhaps it will also mean something momentous for his people, and redemption will come. And Jesus will come. And a greater redemption than that from Egypt will come. a metaphor, an echo, and then finally a puzzle. A puzzle. Because I just want to close then with this puzzle that's there in our passage. Why is Antiochus so hostile toward the Jews? Why is he so obsessed? Why is he so enraged as to go to these lengths that we read of in verses 10 through 13? I mean, this is out of step, isn't it, with what we know about how kind of pagan kings worked in those days. Normally, they were very tolerant of other religions. They respected the religions of the nations they conquered. They didn't want to offend the gods of the nations they conquered. They didn't kind of charge in and sabotage their whole religious system. Why is Antiochus doing that? Why is he so obsessed? Look at verse 10, which is a strange verse. It grew great, that's the horn, that's Antiochus, even to the host of heaven, that's the angels there then, I think. And some of the host, that's the angels, and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. What on earth is that talking about? Antiochus trampling stars on the ground, how can he do that? Well, stars, the stars here are probably a reference back to Joseph's dream in Genesis 37, where you remember he sees 11 stars bowing down to him. What are the 11 stars? His brothers, the tribes of Israel. He's the 12th star. Stars are established there as being a symbol of Israel. And when then Antiochus here tramples the stars to the ground, it's talking probably about Israelites, Jews, trampling them to the ground. Now that doesn't seem to take us any further into answering the question I raised a moment ago. Why is he so obsessed with being hostile toward the Jews? Well, once you've established that stars reference, it perhaps for some of you makes a bell ring, a New Testament bell ring. Revelation chapter 12, which I think casts light on this. Because in Revelation chapter 12, we read this from verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. Again, Israel being pictured. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And so it goes on. Verse 4, we read of a third of the stars of heaven being cast to the earth. Very similar language to Daniel 8. What's it talking about? Again, Israel being battered, being assaulted, being assailed. Who's doing it in Revelation 12, though? This is my question. It's this dragon. Who's the dragon? The dragon is Satan. In Revelation 12, then, we're being given this kind of summary of Old Testament history. And it's saying that throughout the Old Testament, Satan was continually assaulting the stars. That is Israel, the people of God. How was he doing that? Well, he was doing it, of course, through human agents. And nowhere was he doing it more conspicuously than through this man, Antiochus Epiphanes. In other words, behind Antiochus was a greater power than Antiochus. I think that's probably what is being referred to in verse 24. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. Satan is behind Antiochus. Satan is bashing the Jews through Antiochus. That's why he's so obsessive, because he's in the grip of a greater power. He's in the grip of the dragon. He's in the grip of Satan. Now you say, Dan, this is supposed to be comforting. Where's the comfort in this? Well, the comfort is here. Why, according to Revelation 12, is Satan so keen to bash Israel throughout the Old Testament? Why is Satan so obsessed with the Jews? Because the Jewish nation is pregnant. Pregnant with what? Pregnant with a Messiah. Jesus is going to come from the Jews. That's why Satan hates the Jews. And that's why Antiochus hates the Jews, because he's in the grip of Satan who hates the Jews. And Satan is trying here in Daniel 8, in the events prophesied in Daniel 8, Satan is trying to stop Jesus from coming into this world. What you read in verses 10 to 13 is a satanic attempt to prevent you from having a saviour. It's a satanic attempt to prevent you from having a Jesus who will die for you on the cross. And the comforting thing is then that we know he failed. Antiochus failed. Satan behind Antiochus failed. Revelation 12 tells us the baby was born and snatched up by God to heaven. Jesus came. Satan couldn't stop him because God was determined to save you and to save me. And we can surely move, I mean, that itself is a wonderful way to finish tonight, but we can move from the big picture to the small scale picture. And the God who protected his people for centuries of Old Testament history from Satan, so that Jesus could come, he's able to protect you throughout your life from Satan, so that you will keep believing in Jesus. And perhaps you're feeling attacked tonight, and that's a great comfort. That God, even in the dark days of Antiochus, when everything seemed to be unraveling, God was not allowing Satan to win. And neither will he in the darkest days of your life. He will keep you. He will hold you fast. Amen.